You're listening to Fintechs, eh? A podcast that explores the innovations and challenges in Canada's fintech landscape. My name is Sue Britton. I'm the CEO of Firefly Growth and an entrepreneur with over 30 years of experience in the financial industry. I also serve on the FinPay Committee, and I'm an advisor for Holt Exchange. Join us as we sit down with industry leaders, trailblazers, and pioneers to discuss their journey, the evolution of fintech, and what's next for Canada's ever-dynamic fintech ecosystem. All right. Well, welcome to another edition of Fintechs A, the Fintechs Canada podcast series. And today I am very happy to welcome Andrew Graham, CEO of Borrowell. Andrew, hello.
Hello, Sue. Great to be here.
Awesome to see you. As I was saying before we jumped on before we hit record, it's a familiar scene seeing you sitting there in your office. You know, I'm wondering where your Eames chair is. That's the only thing.
we move things around here from time to time to keep things fresh. So.
Well, you're such a, I would go as far as say maybe iconic figure in the fintech space in that, you know, I think kind of going back to 2016, I was, you know, listening to you on stage at events and stuff. So it's pretty amazing that you continue to, you know, lend your voice to all the important topics in fintech. But why don't we start with, you know, a proper introduction of you and Borrowell?
Sure. That was a kind way to kick things off. I'm sure we've made a few right decisions along the way, but we've also been fortunate. And to be sort of 10 years into this journey now, I feel very fortunate every day to be doing what I'm doing. So we are approaching the 10-year anniversary of Borrowell. So certainly that's a big milestone in my life and in the company's life. So really excited about the journey. So, you know, going back 10 years, or just before that, you know, I had been working working for different larger corporates in Canada, saw a real opportunity in the consumer credit space in particular, and just the lack of exciting innovation that was available in Canada at that time in the consumer credit space in particular. And, you know, that sort of led me on the journey that would ultimately become Borrowell. And you know, I think that was sort of 2014, which was a really exciting time in the Canadian fintech world, where there was quite a few different companies that have persevered and grown, began their lives around that time. So I'm sort of happy to be here with you and to be talking about these issues. The short version of the Borrowell story is we've always been focused on making consumer finance and consumer credit work better. How we've done that has certainly changed. So we've had a number of different iterations or pivots, if you want, over the years, as many companies do. Our first product that we went to market with was a digital personal loan focused on, you know, made really for prime consumers. So consumers with strong credit who were looking to refinance credit card debt. So credit cards often charge, you know, upwards of 19 or 20% mm-hmm. interest on an annual basis. There's, you know, lots of people carry credit card balances in Canada. So there's an opportunity to sort of refinance credit card balances at lower rates and still earn good returns for investors. So that was the model we went to market with. We, from day one, were what was called a marketplace lender, meaning that we didn't carry balance sheet risk ourselves. We had buyers from day one. You know, we would essentially originate a group of loans every day and sell it overnight to a group of buyers that included over the years banks, credit unions, high net worth individuals, and it was really exciting way to go into the market. It's not easy at all to launch a lending business. You need to raise both equity capital, you need loan capital, and it's hard to make the pitch for loan capital when you haven't made any loans before as a business. So we were really, you know, able to get that off the ground in an exciting way, and ultimately did about $100 million of lending volume before, you know, really essentially moving to a different model a number of years ago, which is where we are today. We today talk about our business as having three parts. We help people understand their credit, and we're probably best known as being the first company in Canada that offers credit scores and credit reports for free. And it was really fun yesterday, I guess, and you know, you and I are speaking in late February 2024. Just the other day, Rob Carrick, who's one of the personal finance writers in the Globe, had a piece about free credit score. He said, you know, that one of the most empowering developments in personal finance in the last 10 years in Canada has been easy access to credit score. So we're certainly, you know, part of the part of that journey. We were the first company to offer it here. And today, you know, there are others, there are banks and others that offer free credit score too. We certainly like to think of ourselves as being the pioneers in that space. So that's sort of the understand your credit. We have a whole bunch of tools, of course, to help people, you know, see more than just their score, but understand what's driving score, how can they improve their score, you know, what kinds of products could they qualify for if they improve their score? Those are some of the key questions that we strive to answer. We help people. That's sort of the first pillar. The second pillar is we help people use their credit. And that means putting together the right portfolio of financial products for them. So, you know, we have many different lenders, many different providers of, you know, savings accounts, of insurance products, of credit cards, personal loans, mortgages, you name it, on our platform. And we're able to do a really good job, you know, matching the right consumer to the right product at the right time. And we can do that, of course, because we have access to the credit data that when someone checks their credit score with Borrowell, we can then use that to match them to the right provider of credit. And we have very deep relationships with banks and with others on our platform, other fintech companies that offer products, where we have a lot of insight into their underwriting models. So we really try to, you know, avoid consumers wasting their time. I mean, there's no point in putting a credit card in front of someone or a loan option in front of someone if they're not going to qualify, right? We want to be able to show people the most personalized experience, you know, for them, the most personalized group of products. And so we use data to do that. And that's like a really key part of our business. And then the final pillar, just to complete the story today, is we help consumers build their credit. So we have some really exciting products that are great for people who are trying to improve their credit or who are new to credit, maybe new to Canada. One of the products I'm most excited about is our Rent Advantage product. Again, a sort of a first in certainly in this market, where we allow consumers to report rental payments to Equifax, and that helps build their credit because it's one of the really sort of unfair aspects of our credit system that a homeowner who's paying a mortgage is building credit history. Traditionally, a renter who's paying maybe the same amount as their neighbor next door is paying a mortgage, if that renter's, you know, not using our service or otherwise reporting rent, then that's just not building credit history. So we want to help renters, you know, qualify for a mortgage later on if they want, or an auto loan or what have you. And so we think, you know, that's a great product that helps people improve their credit history and their ability to get cheaper products in the future.
Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me, and we were talking before about, you know, my experience at Beam Credit Union over the last couple of months, like, you know, it's your story and your offerings are such a great example of the things that, you know, financial institutions have not been able to do, right? And maybe are starting to realize that they need to do, but I find that there's more education still to do within, you know, our ecosystem than one would expect after so many years of you and I and others talking about these concepts and these things that are so important. I'd love to ask a couple of questions about, you know, like, for instance, you mentioned, you know, being able to match somebody with the right, you know, product. Like, when you get this insight into how the, you know, your partners are, I'm not sure if you call them that, but the financial institutions that where you know what their, you know, credit models are, their decisioning process, like, you must see such a plethora of, you know, of different approaches. And would you say, I don't know if you can speak to it generically or not, but like, is there any innovation happening out there in that regard?
Look, I think there is innovation happening. I mean, we are seeing new entrants come into the market with different kinds of different products you know, for different sectors, you know, of the market. You know, so an aspect of this that's been exciting for us is we recently worked with a partner to help co-create a lending product with them. Really, because we have such, a unique perspective on the market, we can see where there's gaps and sort of say, look, there's a whole group of consumers with this credit profile who are not being well served.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we can do a very targeted testing. And we've done this for multiple partners where we've helped multiple partners, multiple, you know, lenders, banks, and what have you, you know, test offers or test a new product construct with a part of our market. And so, you know, we love that. We love helping others innovate, and that's going to lead to only to, you know, more options and better options for consumers. So, you know, we're kind of uniquely placed to do that. I mean, there's other ways to market your products if you're a financial services company, but we, you know, allow you to do that in a much more targeted way where you can say, I want someone, you know, with this credit profile who's maybe already a customer or maybe is explicitly not a customer, you know, because of the data visibility we have, we can do that sort of thing.
And they're a captive audience. So, and the actual, like, you'd be amazed at how much of this, you know, sort of not matching your customer to the appropriate product actually has to do with technology and data. And, you know, maybe the fact that the, either you don't know enough about your customer or the, you know, the decisioning process is manual or has, you know, outdated business rules or things like that. And yeah, it's interesting. I would say that, like, you know, that is such an area of need, probably across the board. Even the biggest probably still have outdated, you know, systems that don't really incorporate today's reality for consumers.
Yeah, I mean, the what we found is there's sort of like a, you know, crawl, walk, run approach here. You know, because we're in a position where we can see credit data for millions of consumers and we can see it changing week to week to week, you know, we can see when someone, you know, took a specific credit card, for example, right? Like last week they didn't have this card, this week they have it. So what was their credit, what were their credit characteristics last week or 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago? So you have a, you can get a pretty good sense just from the data that we have access to as to what qualification looks like. So that's sort of step one. Step two is we then work with our partners to sort of say, hey, look, like help us refine our thinking here. If there's specific characteristics you're looking for, you know, help us do that. I mean, we're obviously very, very conscious of privacy. You know, we don't share,
of course,
you know, customer data in any sort of identifiable way with our partners. That's just not something we ever do. But there's lots of ways, even with respecting privacy, that we can incorporate, you know, get a much better sense of who's going to qualify for what. And then, you know, that just makes things better for everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're very, I can speak for us anyway, we're very focused on, you know, achieving financial wellness for our members and being a credit union and not having, you know, a nonprofit essentially gives us the ability to do that. Like who else better to be able to actually give the end, you know, consumer what they need versus what, you know, our sales targets tell us we need to sell them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about open banking. Let's just jump right into that topic, because I think, I've been noticing there's, you know, a bit of a roadshow kind of happening right now with Abraham and Colin Deacon and some of the, you know, familiar names in the open banking world. But Senator Colin Deacon. So you've got, you know, a lot of data and you've been a very big, you know, sort of voice about saying, you know, it's the way that you have to actually, you know, deliver your service today is not ideal because you have to, you know, use screen scraping. Where I was actually going to go with my starting point, which maybe not, you know, you may want to choose a different one, is, you know, what you've been able to do has been so innovative and so necessary. And you know, are you confident that open banking, as you know, institutions start to implement it, either ahead of regulation or because of it, that, you know, things are going to get more, you know, sort of safe and secure, and also it's not going to take anything away from, you know, your customer base?
Sure. I mean, look, we're very, we've long been very big proponents of open banking at Borrowell, and we've been part of these conversations for a long time. I think in many ways, you know, the introduction of free credit score is a great example of all the good that can happen when consumers get more access to data, right? I mean, yeah. Thankfully, we didn't need open banking to be a reality to be able to make credit scores available. You know, we were able to do that, you know, in partnership with Equifax. And but it shows you, like, look, you make data available that's relevant to a consumer about their financial situation, and there's a lot of good that comes of that, both from an educational perspective, from a product, you know, the ability to choose the right financial products for yourself. So, you know, in many ways, like, open banking is really at the core of what we do. And I think there are just so many more opportunities that will come from true open banking in Canada. I talked about our Rent Advantage product, which allows a consumer to report their rent payments to Equifax in order to build their credit history. Well, the lack of open banking in Canada today is the single largest impediment to scaling that product, for us, because there's an obligation on us when we were reporting, that consumers made their rent payment. There's an obligation on us to be able to verify that. You have to do some sort of verification. We can't, the integrity of the credit data is an important aspect of our financial system. So how do we verify that? Well, we verify it by, you know, checking that the withdrawal in a bank account matches the withdrawal
from
the terms of a lease, essentially. So how do we do that? Well, we've got to access the bank account, and today with the consumer's permission, of course. And so today, the only way to do that is with screen scraping, and that's just such an imperfect process. It can take 90 seconds, 2 minutes, 3 minutes using screen scraping tools to connect to a bank account. That's a terrible experience for a consumer. Yep. We have very high, that's probably the most, every company talks about funnels where you go from sort of an interested consumer to a converted consumer. That step in the funnel where we're connecting to a bank account is one of the worst performing steps. And no wonder, because it's a really challenging step for consumers. And then not only that, but, we verify every month that you've paid your rent on time. And, often we have to reconnect in a meaningful percentage of cases. We have to ask the consumer to re-enter or reconnect their bank account with our system to verify rent payments every month. You know, imagine if with your Netflix subscription, you had to log back in and enter your credit card information 30% or 40% of the time. I mean, it just would be terrible. So that's really that's the reality in Canada today. I think there's really no question that it's needed. Just to complain for a minute. I mean, we've seen occasionally studies come out that say, well, when you ask Canadians, do you want open banking? A low percentage say yes, or a low percentage know what it means. And I think that's just really a silly question to ask.
It is.
I think if you surveyed Canadians and you said, are you in favor or against, the TCP/IP protocol, a lot would say, I have no opinion, I'm against it, it's scary. But then you're like, well, do you want email? And they'd be able to be like, yeah, I love email. Email's great. How could I live without email? And you're like, well, a technical enabler of email, is this, arcane kind of protocol. And to me, open banking is the same thing. Like, why should anyone care about open banking in the abstract? What you should ask is, do you want to be able to report your rent to a credit bureau? Or do you want to be able to show to a potential mortgage lender that you've been making loan payments on time in your bank account? And I think if you ask those sorts of questions, I'm very confident you're going to get an overwhelming number of Canadians that say yes. The fact that open banking is the technical way to do that,
I know.
It kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it a bit amusing. Like, what's the latest term that we're supposed to be using? Consumer driven banking.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. And whatever.
Sure. And by the way, I think that's a great term, and we're happy to we use that frequently or sort of interchangeably these days with open banking. It was great to see the progress that was announced there, and we're really really keen to sort of see this process move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, my complaint is I'm just hoping it's not a signal that, you know, we're not going to deal with small businesses, because, you know, at least half, probably, maybe more of the million small businesses out there are connecting their accounting software, want to connect their bank to their accounting software. And, you know, it is a terrible experience in for the most part. And so I'm hoping that, you know, that name isn't a nod to, well, we're not going to tackle small business, you know, day one, because, like, you can't sort of empathize as much with the pain of a small business as you can of a consumer who, you know, has the problems of, you know, having bad credit because they can't, you know, demonstrate the same ability to be responsible as someone who pays a mortgage through their credit score. But, like, at the same time, you know, small businesses almost don't function without accurate accounting systems.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're absolutely right. I think I'm optimistic. I think both the politicians involved and government officials involved really get the opportunity here for small business as well. So I believe that despite the name, there will be a good outcome for small business too. But I mean, let's see.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think if you're building products for consumers and businesses, you understand, you know, the whole process of, it's like if someone asked, you know, do you need Borrowell? They'd be like, well, what does Borrowell do? You know, you have to talk about the problem that you solve.
Exactly.
Right, for your customers.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the issue with asking and or caring about, you know, building awareness about what open banking is or what consumer-driven banking is. That's not just a very small story. And because I do have this, you know, fortunate position to be working inside a financial institution right now, not full-time, but full-time enough that I'm at the board meetings and so on. And I was giving the example of being able to, and, you know, well, Simple is in a great spot right now because they have access as a regulated securities dealer to be able to clear their own payments, right? And so moving money from your bank account to Wealthsimple is super easy now. But the conversation I you know, had with some of the board members and others in the room was, you know, even just the simple fact of how many of you have a Wealthsimple account, and several hands went up. You know, the point was all of them would have had to share their, you know, banking credentials in order to do that. And they're like, well, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm like, well, okay, you didn't. But, you know, you have a specific reason why you want a Wealthsimple account, you know, or why you want a Borrowell account. You don't know that you're violating the terms of your online banking agreement, and that you actually are the one that will be liable. You know, I'm sure nobody will actually follow through with that kind of thing. But anyway, it's still a very much got to talk about what you're doing, not the name of it. So anyway.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, look, I think, you know, financial companies, whether fintechs or banks across the country, you know, need to get their head around that. And many have, but everyone needs to get their head around the fact that there is going to be some form of open banking. And the idea that a consumer is not allowed to share, or a small business is not allowed to share their data, and if anything bad happens, it's their fault. I mean, I just think that's the old way of thinking.
Yeah.
And if people haven't got the message yet, then now's the time, because, you know, the federal government has made clear that open banking is happening. You know, virtually every other advanced economy has done open banking in some form. So, you know, that kind of thinking just isn't going to work for much longer.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. So how do you feel things are going to, like, what's the next, you know, 12 months going to feel like? Yeah, like, maybe from your perspective with open banking, like, do you think they're, you know, I mean, I hear that most are saying because of, and it doesn't really matter, you know, if we have a change in, you know, our party that's leading the federal government. But at the end of the day, most are just proceeding with the things that you can implement with respect to enabling some aspects of open banking. And so do you think, like, how is there going to be like a big, you know, sort of bang, or is this over the next 12 months, 18 months, however long, how can you maybe forecast the future of what this is going to be like for you as a fintech?
Our understanding, my understanding is that, you know, in probably the second budget implementation bill, which would be in the fall of this year of 2024, there will be a lot more detail put out around how open banking will work. So in the fall economic statement, we had like a 6-page outline of how open banking will work, some of the sort of the key principles, which was very helpful. And I, you know, what we need to turn that into is sort of the next level of detail down. So in the United States, just before the holidays, you know, the US published its sort of next level of detail on open banking, which was about a 100-page document. And then they used that for a consultation period. So it's that sort of next level down that we need in Canada. And I think there are some big questions that need to be answered there. For example, what entity, what part of the federal government is going to be the called the governance entity, or sort of the organization that's going to make this work? Is there going to be a new entity, you know, Open Banking Canada, whatever you want to call it, or is it going to be an existing entity that takes over, that takes on this work of making the open banking system real and work in Canada? So I think that's a big question. But then there's lots of detail, of course, that goes into open banking. What technical standards are we using? You know, what's the accreditation process going to look like for a company that wants to be part of the open banking process? You know, what are the service levels that are required? If I, you know, ask my bank to share data with Borrowell, you know, how many milliseconds does it have to answer? I mean, there's a lot of detail like that that needs to be fleshed out, and I believe is being fleshed out, you know, now.
Yeah.
And so we're looking forward to seeing that next level of detail and understanding what the governance entity will be over the coming months. And I think, look, as you pointed out, the federal conservatives have been, you know, really thoughtful of open banking. They've you know, I think really understood from the beginning.
Are you assuming a conservative win?
Look, I mean, whoever wins, you know, we want to see this.
I'm just kidding.
Happen. So we're happy to work with whoever's working.
Yeah.
If you believe I think a lot can happen in 2024, and certainly a lot of people believe there's not going to be a federal election in 2024. So I'm really hopeful that we can make a lot of progress this year.
Yeah, and like just listening to you, I mean, it reminds me that, you know, other countries have moved fairly quickly to implement open banking and get through all of this stuff. Even the US is moving faster than, you know, I think historically has moved on big changes like this. Like, what is it that Canada is doing wrong? Like, why is it taking us so long? We're smaller, you know, what is it? Do you have an opinion on that? Or what could make things go faster?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, there's a certain amount of conservatism when it comes to how we regulate the financial sector, and certainly in some instances that served us well. Right, we didn't, you know, as you'll hear over and over when you talk to people in larger institutions or in the industry groups who represent them. I mean, we didn't have a banking failure in 2008, like, you know, like the US had. We didn't have any banking failure, you know. So, you know, we have had a really robust secure system, which is great. And that's terrific.
Yeah.
I think sometimes that's come at the expense of innovation, or there's a feeling that it's at the expense of innovation. Personally, I think
we can have
innovation and security, right? We should be aiming for both.
Of course.
I think there's a sense that, you know, one sometimes would need to come at the expense of the other. I mean, there's certainly evidence for this. The former deputy minister of finance was asked at a committee, a Senate committee, by Senator Deakin, you know, where is open banking at? This was a number of months ago. And his answer was to essentially talk about the importance of financial stability. And I, you know, just to support that, I mean, I thought that was you know, a bit of a telling reaction. And I think we need to educate people to sort of say, this isn't about making the system less secure. In fact, if anything, it's about making it more secure, because we have millions of people today who are using screen scraping, which is a, you know, objectively less secure technology than an API-based, properly permissioned, you know, the first instance read-only kind of open banking system. So, you know, we've just got to meet everybody around the table to sort of say, this is about innovation and security. It's not a trade-off. This is about both.
Yeah. 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 The meaning of the word hubris was something that I really only, you know, sort of became or began to understand when it was used so often to describe our large financial institutions and the people within them. And I don't mean to be, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful or anything, but there is that sense of, we know better, we know best, you know, we're the ones that know how to, you know, serve the needs of Canadians the best. Anyhow, any other big regulatory things on your mind, like beyond that?
I mean, you know, modernizing the payment system. So what people call real-time rails is, you know, long overdue. And something else that I and others are watching closely, like we just, you know, it is, you know, crazy how long it can take to move money in this country. And again, here we're behind other countries as well. So I think that's another really big issue in financial services and in fintech circles these days too.
Yeah. Yeah. How much, you know, this may seem like a strange question, but like, how deep have you gone into kind of the whole, you know, sort of understanding of financial wellness of Canadians and their ways to, you know, maybe are there regulations that need to change or things that need to change in order to make sure that, you know, people all have the right products and that there's a responsibility with those who provide those products to make sure of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we have, sort of a unique insight into financial wellness because we see the credit data of so many consumers updated, you know, in close to real time. So, you know, we've been able to observe over the last few years how, you know, bankruptcies have, you know, increased or decreased, how missed payment activities increased or decreased. So we have a pretty strong perspective on the financial health of consumers in Canada. And the short version of that is, consumers in Canada came through COVID remarkably well. There was, you know, very low levels of personal bankruptcy, low levels of delinquency, you know, during COVID and is essentially coming out of it. We're now seeing sort of a return to normal, if you will, with levels of bankruptcy and delinquency returning to where they in the range of where they might have been pre-COVID. But you know, it's been really interesting to observe how that worked and how, you know, government programs and other things really did help stabilize the financial picture for many consumers. So I think that's, you know, that, and you know, we've been able to do sort of more fun things like look at what's the average credit score by city in Canada or by province.
Oh,
you know, he's looking at those things for, you know, just to give you an example of the kind of work that we've done in that area. So it's interesting to see. You know, how different geographies and different different kinds of people or different situations are able to navigate the financial system. I continue like really fundamental to my belief. One of my core beliefs that animates the work we do at Borwell is personal finances are really complicated, right? Like this is not a simple world we live in where it's really intuitive for most people to know how to optimize their finances. And I think there's lots of really unhelpful advice out there, you know, buy less avocado toast or what have you. And I think what we really need to do is help consumers navigate this world in a much simpler way. And so I think that's a core belief for us. I think another core belief for us is that, you know, for most consumers, there's, you know, one financial company is highly unlikely to be able to satisfy all your needs at all stages in life. So, yeah. You know, most consumers, creating a portfolio of financial products, especially over time, is going to be really important, right? So the kind of credit card you have when you're 20 and coming out of school may not be the optimal kind of credit card for you when you're 30 or 40 or 50. And you could say the same thing about other kinds of financial products as well. So, you know, core to our mission and our, you know, reason for existing is to help consumers navigate those kinds of decisions and be able to optimize their choices. Just like a company like an Expedia or a Kayak, you know, helps you plan your vacation by pulling together, you know, a list of all the different flights work for you on a certain day and sorting them by cost or by time or whatever. You know, I think, you know, we have a role similar to that we play in the system. And, you know, alongside that goes financial education, which we can do with, you know, because of the data we've access to. So, you know, we have a very fulsome view of a consumer's, the liability side of their balance sheet. In other words, their debts and how those are changing.
Yep.
That allows us to make lots of, to put lots of, you know, context specific financial information in front of a consumer. So what does that mean in sort of simpler terms? Well, you know, credit score is a great financial education tool. It's like it takes a whole bunch of complexity and simplifies it into a 3-digit number. And so, you know, in some ways it gamifies it. So we can, there's challenges with the credit system. It's not a perfect system, but it is really powerful what can happen. Consumer their credit score and you say, you know, you're below average. And if you want to get to average or above average, you need to, you know, pay down this outstanding debt and, you know, decrease the amount of money you're putting on your credit card every month. You know, those sorts of concrete actions that then lead to tangible results. And I don't mean just a higher credit score, but like a lower interest rate on your next mortgage.
Do you think that is something that most Canadians understand, like the way in which they can, you know, manage their, like, or not the way, but the benefits of having a better credit score, other than the obvious?
Look, I think it's becoming, you know, more and more widely known how important it is to track your credit and your credit score. We continue to sign up new Borrowell members at a very fast rate. There is lots of interest out there in understanding credit. And we see just a ton, like the repeat usage we see where people are coming in every week or every month to see how their credit have changed, you know, remains a really meaningful, even for people that signed up 2 years, 3 years, even 5 years ago, right? We've been out doing this in 2016. So we now have years and years of data, and we can see that, you know, for many consumers, this is a really important part of their financial wellness journey, you know, tracking and improving their credit.
Very cool. So you've been at this for a while. What are some of this is an off script question, but like, do you have what was your biggest challenge that you had to overcome along the way?
I think the biggest challenge for us was figuring out figuring out what the right product was for our aspiration. So our aspiration has always been to help, you know, help Canadians better navigate the financial system and the credit part of that in particular. And our first product was a personal loan. And I think we did a really good job putting that together. It was a very easy application process, you know, low rates, much lower rates than what, you know, most people would get on their credit card, for example. But for a whole variety of reasons we could get into, that was just a much harder product to scale in Canada. Americans at all levels of sort of credit behavior have really taken to personal loans. In Canada, that's much less true for many these with strong credit scores. Home equity lines of credit, other kinds of lines of credit are in many ways a more common product. And personal loans have not had the impact here that they've had in the US, at least for sort of prime and super prime consumers. And so we have to pivot. We had to sort of A, realize that, and B, pivot to sort of say, okay, well, how else can we go after this problem? And we did a couple of things. We announced a partnership with one of the largest banks in Canada, where we started building some, co-building products with them. That took a lot of work and was exciting. Yeah. And then we also launched free credits for, and, ultimately, the market reaction of free credits for was instantaneous and huge, and really, helped us evolve into the model where we are today, where we don't just offer a Borrowell loan. We now offer, loans from virtually all lenders in Canada, and are able to match the right product to the right consumer. So, being able to, I would say that was our biggest challenge, was being able to sort of stay true to our North Star, to our mission, but change how we do it.
Right. Okay. How about your biggest, the highest moment?
There's been so many highs. I think, crossing thresholds is really exciting. So, when we crossed 1 million members on the platform, when we crossed 2 and 3 million members, those have been big, exciting thresholds. Like, it's as we talk about as the team, like, in ways big or small, we have made an impact in the lives of literally millions of people. Some people are daily or weekly, and that's really exciting. Other people might check those for only periodically, but that's pretty, I think that's super gratifying. And then when we get, we have a Slack channel that ingests all of our mobile app reviews from iOS and from the Play Store, and seeing a positive comments from a real human where they say, I love this app, it's helped me improve my credit score by 30 points or 50 points, or I now qualify for that mortgage. That combination of the big numbers with the real human story is really gratifying. Mm-hmm. I think it's super gratifying to think that, again, in ways big or small, we've helped make life better, less stressful, or for some, for people that are out there.
I mean, there should be more.
Finances are more, so much more than just numbers, right? There's so much emotion tied up. There's so much stress tied up.
God,
stressful areas, of human existence in at this period of time, and being able to help people navigate that and frankly feel less stress. We can't make everyone, wealthy or everyone financially secure.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a plan and say, okay, well, I understand where I'm at now, and I understand what I have to do, and I'm going to go there. And that's that feeling of sort of agency and of de-stressing is really what we're after.
How have you, you have 3 kids together. Is that right? Yeah. How old are they?
10, 8, and 4.
Oh, wow.
Two girls, and my youngest is a boy.
And they've grown up as you've been building this company. Yeesh. Wow. That's a lot of work. That must have been, an interesting, juggle over time. I have 3, but mine are so much older. Even now I'm towards the end of my career and waiting for grandkids. But how have you kind of managed to sort of maintain balance with between building a family and building a business?
I mentioned at the off the top that Borrowell's approaching its 10-year anniversary. My oldest child just turned 10. So she was born when, essentially right after I quit I left my last sort of corporate job. And this was sort of like as the idea for Borrowell was sort of incubating, in my mind, and I'm working to sort of develop what would become Borrowell. She was born early in that journey. So, I mean, the first thing to say is I've had a very supportive spouse who's has a great career herself and has been just super helpful to have someone who's so supportive and obviously can be financially in those early days wasn't being paid. So I think that's the first thing to say. I think it's been gratifying to have my 3 kids and Borrowell sort of all growing at once. But I think, one thing that's been, I think, a real positive is, kids are, I think, really grounding, at least my kids are. And if I've had a really good day at the office, that doesn't, they don't really care. And they'll, tell me yeah. my fault as a parent. And if I've had a really bad day at the office, if something really, you know, if we've had really big challenges, they're great at, you know, giving me a hug. And they also don't care that, you know, things are going well or badly at the office. So there's a certain sort of, you know, they kind of bring you back, whether it's down or up, you know, yeah. kids do a great job bringing you back. So, you know, my wife and I always wanted to have kids. We're fortunate to have kids. So I can't imagine, you know, not having done that, you know, because of having a company. I'm a big believer that a good life has balance. And, as much as there's very, very busy periods building a business and a startup, I think that's unavoidable. You know, I really believe you got to do it. You got to do it all. You got to try to figure out a way to do it all. And nothing's perfect, right? You're not going to be a perfect founder. You're not going to be a perfect parent. But you got to kind of do your best and muddle through. And I think that's what life's about, or what it's been about for me.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know. I'd love it. I mean, so off topic, but what might have been different, you know, if you hadn't have left corporate and started your own thing and had a passion, more of a passion driven, you know, sort of career, versus, and I'm not sure what you were exactly doing before, but, I think most people that, you know, go and start something are usually, the opportunity is greater in the thing that they're starting for them personally and professionally than it is in the thing that they're leaving. Right. But yeah, anyway.
I think also, going through the entrepreneurial journey, I think has made me a much better parent. I think more than anything, I've really learned, so much more about, you know, resilience, and, you know, things are rarely as good or as bad as they seem in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, we've like, you know, I don't think there's any entrepreneur out there that in an honest moment wouldn't say they've had really tough days. We've certainly had tough days at Borrowell where something hasn't gone right, or, you know, a funding round didn't close when we wanted it to, or what have you. I've got lots of stories like that.
Yeah.
And I think what you learn is you just got to learn that part of the journey in life is you know, taking that punch in the face and picking yourself up and I'm going to keep going here. And then realizing the next day that it's like, you know, it actually wasn't that bad. So I think, I think a lot of that is applicable to parenting as well, to sort of say like, more than anything, I want to teach my kids resilience. So like, there's a lot that is not great about this world. There's a lot of bad things that are going to confront you. And, you know, what you've got to do more than anything is, you know, figure out how to work through it. And, you know, just the getting up off the mat is like one of the most important skills in life. And that's really, you know, one of the biggest things I've learned as an entrepreneur.
That's impactful. That's to me, because it's, you know, you think about resilience and at this stage, like resilience to persevere with your fintech, resilience to, you know, keep trying to innovate inside a big company. Like it's so applicable right now, to, you know, not accept the failure as the thing that is going to define you, right? Like just keep going, or a failure that failure actually isn't, maybe it is going to define you, but for the good, right? You're going to learn and you're going to keep going. Interesting. Well, shall we leave it at that?
Sure. Yeah, let's leave it at that. That's a good message to end on.
Yeah, good message to end on. And I'm sure we could talk a lot more about you know, the business and you know, I think if someone Googled you, you'd probably find a few hundred, maybe even getting to 1,000 media interviews and videos, and there's no shortage of Andrew Graham on YouTube, I'm sure.
Not only is there no shortage, I'm sure there's a big surplus. I wouldn't recommend that exercise to anybody.
I know. I hear you. All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I hope everybody gets some little nuggets out of your amazing comments. And yeah, we'll see you in the ecosystem somewhere, maybe.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks, you.
Thanks for joining us. Looking for more insights? Visit us at fintechscanada.ca or follow us on LinkedIn. We'll see you next time for more on Canada's latest fintech innovations.